thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Doing it right now.
Here's John Williams.
Although, I forgot what it was. That'll happen. It's 108. This is John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Thanks for tuning in.
Lord have mercy.
We're here weekdays from 1 to 3. Remember, on Facebook, you can always find me, WGN King John. It's Thursday, you know, so the Mincing Rascals drop tonight. Around 5 o'clock, a brand new podcast for you from the award-winning Mincing Rascals team. By the way, they talked a little bit about what the News Click is about today. We asked, what do you think about making able-bodied SNAP recipients work 30 hours a week to get food benefits? That's the way the question reads. The Rascals said it's actually 80 hours a month, about 20 hours a week. I swear I saw 30, but that's the way the question reads now. And 39% of you said, that's a good idea. 45% said, I'll bet it's not that simple. And 15% said, that's a bad idea. People will go hungry who need our help. I don't know where you are on that. I was surprised to hear the liberal-leaning Mincing Rascals all go to good idea. Make the people who can work to get SNAP benefits. 20 hours a week, you can do that. Maybe that motivates you. Maybe that actually furthers your life. So that's the News Click. And to be honest with you, I'm a little surprised that it isn't about 70% of the people saying good idea. The text messages were overwhelming when we brought this up yesterday when we talked to somebody at the state that was talking about it and who did not love the idea, by the way. The people at the state of Illinois go, we're in the business of handing out assistance. We don't think there should be that many strings attached. I'm just recollecting the general thrust of that conversation, and that some of the people who you think should be working, work for them won't be that easy to get. But if you have children, if you have a disability, if you have a mental condition, there's a number of things that would preclude you from having to work to get your food stamps. And the interesting thing, too, is that what triggered that is that the unemployment rate dropped below 4%. So there's the silver lining to all of this either way. It's 3.9%. The idea being when there are that many jobs, when unemployment is that low, you will be able to find work for 20 hours a week, for goodness sakes. That was the News Click at WGNradio.com. You know, it was 10 years ago yesterday. Steve, I don't know if you were working with me doing the news at the time. Were you?
Yeah, I believe I was.
So we were in the Tribune Tower in the Showcase Studio, just like the Today Show said, if you've ever been by there. Beautiful building with a beautiful studio right on the sidewalk. People would wave to us. We'd wave back at them. It was lovely. They're redoing all of that now, gutting the building for condos, for fancy folks, whatever. And 10 years ago yesterday, I was sitting in the studio. The position of my seat was such that I would look at a guest and then beyond the guest to a glass wall window, and I would be able to see outside. So as I was chatting with our guest about the toy and game fair in town, you know, history of toys and games and toys we all know, love, and remember, a woman walked up on the sidewalk who was, I'm just going to guess, 5'5", weighed 80 pounds, looked strung out, disheveled, wasn't wearing all of her clothes. She had a concrete cinder block, like you see on the sides of buildings, lifted up over her head. That cinder block weighed a significant percentage of her body weight. I'll bet that thing weighed 10 pounds. She did not weigh 90. She had it lifted up over her head, walked up to the window, and threw it into the glass and punched a hole in the first window. I don't know if the second window was bulletproof, but we had two barriers, two windows. So it went through the first layer, didn't crash through the second one. We didn't miss a beat. The interview kept, we didn't even mention it, didn't even acknowledge it. The lady then turned on her heel and walked out into the traffic on Michigan Avenue. Three lanes southbound, three lanes northbound. And she laid down in the middle of the middle lane northbound, spread eagle, waiting for somebody to hit her. And nobody did. Cars stopped. Eventually, emergency vehicles got there, and they took her away. Never knew what happened to that lady, but clearly she was having an episode of some sort, either because of drugs or something else. She was not a well person. I felt so bad for her. I always wondered what happened to her. Did she get treatment? Is she well? Did she survive? I don't know what her story was. But a few of us shared the note of that in the pictures from yesterday, 10 years ago. The things we used to see on Michigan Avenue. We've got brand new studios here, and they're lovely. But the things we used to see on Michigan Avenue in the Showcase studio were memorable. One time I was sitting there about 5 o'clock in the evening, and a couple of people, three of them actually, a man and two women, I would guess each about 55 years old, must have been having a cocktail or two. They were dressed for business. They walked right up to the window and just waved, and I've waved back. And then the lady was starting to wiggle her rear end in her chest and put her hands over the hem of her dress and just pulled it right up over her head and squeezed everything God gave her right into the glass.
Hi, how you doing?
You know, you don't want to get in the habit of acknowledging that or doing play-by-play at the time, because then it just encourages this sort of thing. One time I saw a couple of guys wrestling right in front of the window. They looked like they were maybe 20 years old, maybe college-age kids. And you see all kinds of, you know, fun and mischievous behavior, and they were wrestling, and the one guy was grabbing the other guy and tossing him around. And then I realized, no, this is a mugging. This one guy is stealing the jacket off the back of the other guy, finally ripped it off of him, and then took off. And then the victim took off after them. And then some more people took off after them. I would say about every month we had something like that happen on Michigan Avenue. Now I just see Steve Bertrand in a TV screen. A lovely producer, Elif.
Well, it could be worse.
I know. You're lovely people, and it's a pleasure to be here. Yesterday, we talked about that Naperville teen who's charged with a hate crime. Because what, you know, you can just imagine what the adults in this story thought when they heard it. The school officials or the parents of the two kids, because the way the attorney describes it, the boys are friends. And the one posts the white kid on Craigslist an ad about the black kid saying slave for sale. Are you kidding me? Now he's charged with a hate crime. What's his attorney say after this? There's a funny story online today. It says, Republican or Democrat, there's one thing most people could probably agree on during the impeachment hearings investigating President Trump. Coffee is necessary. Have you seen the picture of the woman chugging a cup of coffee behind Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman?
Oh my God, that's going around all the journalism social media pages. They're like reporter feels.
It's a McClatchy reporter named Emma Dumain, and she's, you know, one of those people in the background, just the heads that are all working their phones and their laptops reporting. And there's this one woman, and she's behind the lieutenant colonel. And let's face it, the hearings have been a little dry. And so she's sitting there, and she tits her head way back. I mean, way back. And now she's like working the cup to get every last ounce out of it. And then you get the feeling somebody said, hey, you're on TV, and that looks weird. And so then she kind of ducks her head like, oh, my God, I got caught. And I thought maybe she was doing it for show, like saying to America, yeah, we know this is really tough. But she said she just wanted to get the last drop of coffee.
I don't think I've ever finished coffee.
Not like that. By that time, it's usually cold. The dregs on the bottom, that's cold. You don't want that.
Yeah, you get them stuck in your teeth for later. It just shows how informal we've become, too, though, because you even have members of Congress sitting there with water bottles in front of them.
Much was said about one of the water bottles on display, too, because nothing else in these hearings is all that compelling or important. All right, let's talk about this story out of Naperville. We're talking about too many stories like this out of Naperville these days. I suppose it's a coincidence. In this case, it's in Naperville Central, freshman, white kid, 14, and evidently has a buddy. This is the way it's playing out in the press. The friend is a black kid. I think it was during school. The white kid posts on Craigslist an ad with a photo of his friend that says slave for sale. And the people commented on it as well, and that wasn't all pretty. Now the state's attorney's office has charged the kid with a couple of counts of hate crimes. Hate crimes. Harry Smith is now, they had to get an attorney, and this is Harry Smith. You're on WGN. Harry, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I appreciate you joining us. That's the way the story's playing out in the papers this week. Is that kind of what happened here?
Well, you know, the state has an obligation to produce whatever their investigation produced, and as of the first court date yesterday, they didn't have, anything. I mean, none of the reports were there. However, they had to make a proffer to the court, and that proffer was Not necessarily along the lines of what you said, but then I was given the opportunity to make that proffer, and you're correct. At least the information I've been able to gather is that these two people, two students, were together when this post was created, at the same lunch table, in fact, and were both aware of what was happening. And, you know, as we are dealing with constant sensitivities towards these things, it morphed out of control, certainly, at least in the eyes of my client, shortly thereafter and later that day at the school.
You've
and the
talked
school
to,
is taking action as well.
Yeah, the boy's been suspended for at least a couple of days, correct?
Yeah, I think he's gone to an in-school suspension at this point in time.
You've talked to the boy then and the boy's parents as well?
I have.
And what's their reaction?
In juvenile court, everybody has to be present on that first date, so mom, dad, and son were there.
What are they saying to you about this?
Well, first and foremost, you know, they are not the least bit naive as to what their own son has created and probably shouldn't get into it factually, but I can certainly say that they proactively, all three of them, mom, dad, son, have reached out in a lot of different ways since it came to light long before any charges were filed. So, you know, I get the sense they are acting in good faith and taking responsibility for the words that were used that were, you know, at the very least hurtful and at the very worst, I guess, criminal, although I am surprised that this was charged as a hate crime.
Harry, you said they reached out. Do you mean they reached out to the other boy and his family?
You know, they'd expressed that to me, that their remorse had been expressed to parents and his friend, who was the subject of the posting, but then the state even produced to me a written apology, which I believe the victim's family had given to the state from my client.
What was the thrust of this then? It wasn't, we'll let the state decide if it's a hate crime or not, or a judge or a jury, but I mean,
I
want to get to what the intent of the two boys was, or at least the white kid. I hate to keep saying white kid and black kid, but we're not using their names, they're juveniles. So the white kid's idea was that this is a lark, isn't this silly and funny? Was that the thrust of it?
Well, without having conducted any independent interviews, I can tell you that it has at least been represented to me that there were mutual racial jokes, epithets, slurs being used at a lunchroom table amongst more than just himself and his friend, and that this was a very poor choice and culmination of that joking around at lunch.
I wonder if the other family would feels the same way, that this was just a joke that ended that way.
It's interesting because when it happened, it is my understanding that it wasn't anybody at that lunchroom table who ran and said this had happened. I'm pretty comfortable with what I have seen, that it came through a response to it being seen on social media, and I'm also pretty comfortable that it was done in the presence of the other person.
So I understand.
So it wasn't,
All right,
so,
but then what's the reaction? And then I did not see the comments underneath that Craigslist posting, but my understanding was there was some piling on, like I'll give a dollar, and I don't know what else would have been put there.
Yeah, but I have heard that, but have not been given those proofs and haven't seen the entire posting, just saw what was, I guess, quoted in the charges themselves.
If it's that, it's just juveniles acting inappropriately. I know that's an understatement, but what should happen in a case like this?
Well, I mean, juveniles acting inappropriately can be handled at the school level, can be handled through a station adjustment or basically law enforcement intervention without criminal involvement. But we're past that, obviously. We are now in a situation where it's in the court system, and specifically the juvenile court system, and there's a myriad of options that could result from all of this.
Yeah, but I'm wondering what you think. I mean, you know, when we gather...
I think that it's a shame, because these people are not unknown to each other, and at least by my client's statements and from what I saw in the what appeared to be an apology, they're friends. So it's a real shame, because their ability to talk and cope with and negotiate it, or whatever two human beings at that age would do about something like this, you know, that's probably not going to be able to happen now because there's law enforcement and a court system involved. And I can at least say with 100% surety that this was not done, as strange as it may sound, by my client with the intent to hurt. I mean, he was rolling on with what he perceived to be what they were doing.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that it's a shame the choice was so poor. It's a shame that it would be as degrading as it was. And those are things he's going to have to be responsible for.
Well, if his intent wasn't to harm and the two boys were mocking each other and this is the post that was the result of that, I just wonder if the other family would say, we don't feel injured by that. I wonder what that other boy's parents feel about that, too.
You know, I can only guess his parents, they'd be horrified by it. So I would never presume to hope or think what they might do next. I hope it helps them to know, and I'm sure they do know. There is remorse on behalf of this person and his parents.
Yeah.
I hope that helps somewhat. But certainly, you know, that is totally their choice.
And it sounds
how to
like
feel about it, because it's an awful thing.
Maybe you don't know the answer to this one either, but if the two boys have had a chance to face-to-face communicate with each other, I wonder if, you know, they...
I don't know. You know, I think they separated ways that day. There's nothing for me to lead me to believe that they separated ways that day or that lunch hour as enemies. I do know that the school has scheduled a time for my client to apologize personally to his friend. That may have happened today.
I'll wrap this up with you now, Harry. What's the next event then in this case?
Well, as his attorney, it would be my goal to answer to this and do it responsibly and do it in such a way that everybody feels like it's been addressed. But I also have to realize that I don't think this was done with the intent to commit a crime against this other person, and hope that the juvenile court system would acknowledge that as well in whatever position they meet out upon him.
You know, when I get to be king, you're not going to be allowed to have your phone in school. I mean, it's nothing good comes of this. I understand.
No, killing people. I'm telling you, you are absolutely right.
The kid's not in custody, and he's due back in court in December. Maybe we'll talk to you after the month turns. I appreciate your time today, Harry.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
His name is Harry Smith, not of CBS Morning News fame, or the CBS Evening News anchor, for that matter. Harry Smith, an attorney in Naperville, representing that kid whose name we don't know. Hey, thank you for all of that news and weather and sports and stuff you did there, Steve Bertrand.
What was your favorite part?
All of it, to be honest with you. I loved each thing that you said there equally.
Yeah, that's nice to hear, John. Thank you.
I'm going to just talk a little later on about this USA Today 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 article that says 6 things you need to know if you haven't been on a plane in a year. I guess you know all of these things. But one of the things they said you can't do is get extra leg room on a seat in a few rows in front of you if it's not occupied. Think about that. You're on a plane. Lucky you, there's a row in front of you and not all the seats are taken. And it's one of those seats where you have a little more leg room in front of that person.
Yeah, I sometimes pay up for that now.
That's what they said, since people are paying a premium for that, even though it's not business class.
No.
You know, but it's like, it's right there.
It's by the emergency door.
And you say, hey, do you mind if I sit there? And they go, yeah, no, you can't. You say, but nobody's there. Yeah, but that's an upgrade, and we're not going to let you sit there. That's a bad plan. Steve, when I get to be king, not only will you be able to take that seat because ain't nobody using it, you didn't know that it was going to be free, for goodness sakes, but at baseball games, after the fourth inning,
you can move up.
Ta-da.
Yeah. So here's the thing, John, about that travel thing.
Yeah.
I don't usually do it because for me it seems like a waste of money. But I've noticed that if you purchase it in advance, the legroom seats, you know, you're guaranteed it. But if there, you can also walk up that day, and if they haven't sold them, they're dirt cheap. They're like $50 extra.
I didn't know that. $50 extra?
Well, they can be $250 extra if you buy them ahead of time.
What are you, 6'6" tall?
Yeah, 6'5", 6'4". But I can, you know, it's not forever. Just squeeze in for a while.
That's one of the things. There's 5 others. I'll get to that after the 2 o'clock edition of WGN Radio News. Ed Shamelia is in our studio. He was here before. He's the national coordinator of the National Marijuana Initiative. Well, welcome back to Chicago, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me back, John.
You still from Texas?
No, Kentucky.
That's what it is.
That's a Kentucky draw. It's confused with Texas every once in a while. Yeah, but it's Kentucky.
No, and now that you mentioned it, I think that is Kentucky.
Yes, it is.
Embrace that, Ed.
Oh, I do.
I do. It's charming. It's warm. It's friendly. So what is the National Marijuana Initiative?
It is one of the three national initiatives that support our 33 HIDAs across the country. And a HIDA is a high-intensity drug trafficking area, of which you have one here in Chicago. And we are the subject matter experts for all things marijuana. So initially what we do and what our initiative looks like is we look at what is going on with the state of marijuana in this country, not only the legalization piece, but we also help with the illicit side still. But primarily we're concentrating on what we're seeing in this country as the country moves towards legalization, either medically and or recreationally.
You were brought in to talk to the DuPage County Chiefs of Police, is that right?
I spoke with them this morning about what to expect come January the 1st as Illinois joins the 11th state to join the recreational legalization model in this country.
So what are you telling cops?
Well, things are going to change. Not everything that they've heard is actually going to happen, but there's some fairly consistent things that we're seeing across the country. One thing that I think nobody really understands is how marijuana has changed and significantly changed. And it's a recent change because most people's concept about marijuana was what it was when they experienced it. And, I'm a product of the late 60s, early 70s. And if we were talking about that marijuana today, I wouldn't waste your time because it was a relatively benign, harmless substance. But what happened when Colorado recreationalized in 12, it changed the dynamics around marijuana altogether. It is now more potent. The potency is gone through the roof. Now, on average, Colorado's seeing potency on average of 20% with some flower exceeding 40%.
Should I worry about that? Because the dosage goes down then. You don't have to smoke or eat as much.
Well, you don't, but the concentration of THC is exponentially greater than it was when you were smoking a joint.
So people are getting higher?
If you can get higher, yes. The duration and the intensity of the high is greater, particularly when you start talking about concentrates. And that's what's driving market share. About 35% is still the crude, what we typically see, the old Cheech and Chong, you roll a joint, smoke it. But about 65% now is something other than the crude drug. It's concentrates, wax, oils, tinctures, vaping, edibles. Gummy bears, yes, sir. That's what's driving market share.
Okay, that's market share. Is that a concern of law enforcement or me? I mean, that's just the other ways people are taking it.
It is because of a couple reasons. Number one, what we always see and what I suspect you're going to see here is an increase in usage rates amongst all age groups, and particularly our younger people, which happen to be the most vulnerable to the harmful consequences of THC.
You're advising cops on all of this and what to do maybe when they encounter it, but are you also against the legalization of recreational marijuana?
Well, that's a complex question.
And, it's a yes or no. Should we or should we not legalize it in Illinois?
I don't think we have enough valid scientific information to make that determination about this drug, particularly as it exists in its current context. Again, if we were talking about what was around 10, 15 years ago, this would be a different discussion. The science of today's marijuana is still evolving as far as the harms. We don't know enough about today's marijuana to make a definitive conclusion. Should we legalize this impairing substance like we've got alcohol?
Well, are things that bad in the Northwest or Colorado? Are things that bad in California?
Yeah, they are. They are bad.
How so? What do you mean
by that? Well, even though in some categories usage rates are going down, marijuana is playing an increasing role with respect to automobile crashes and their involvement, not only in Colorado. The fact, what concerns us the most is the inability in any state, and I suspect your state will not have the capacity to regulate this industry. Nobody is effectively regulating recreational marijuana.
How so? What do you want them to do that they can't or won't?
Well, first of all, nobody's doing anything to address potency, which is driving all the problems with that. Nobody is doing anything with respect to potency. And with that, if you go back to the previous administration in the Cole memo, where President Obama and his Justice Department said, we're not going to touch the states as long as you don't do these eight things. And one of them was diversion, sale to minors, public lands. In every instance, every state that is medical and or recreational is still invited. Even though the Cole memo was rescinded by former Attorney General Sessions, every state still is not in violation of about every 8 principles of this Cole memo. So we're still seeing marijuana produced at record levels at low prices right now, and it is being diverted all over the country. Nothing is being done to keep it in the confines within the state.
This is in the newsroom, Steve Bertrand.
You talk about potency, and something just jumped to me. I didn't hear all of it. I'm sorry. But I know here in Illinois, with the legally raised grown marijuana, they check the potency. And in fact, there's a penalty where if the marijuana in the field, any piece of it, part of it, exceeds the state limit, by law, they have to destroy the entire field. So it seems to me they are monitoring potency here when it's grown legally.
Well, I know what they say they're doing, and they say they're doing this in all the other states, but that's not the reality of what is actually out there. That's not the case. And I suspect that based on your regulatory model and as you roll it out, number one, there are not going to be sufficient funds to do regulation, nor will there be sufficient personnel. The state of Oregon has 3 individuals to regulate the entire industry. Colorado's got 18 individuals to regulate the entire industry. A dispensary or production facility gets inspected once every 36 months. So there is a tendency for, and the fact that what we are finding with the labs that are supposed to be testing potency, California shut 4 labs down that were providing false and inconsistent results. So
what are they doing, juicing it up more?
Yes. It's being driven by demand.
I thought, though, that the idea was that if you professionalize this, there's more quality control. It is regulated. Better that than us get it the way we've been getting it for 100 years.
Well, you know, in theory, that should be the case. That's not what's happening in practice.
So is your suggestion to the state of Illinois to better fund the sort of inspections of the potency and the operations?
Well, I think if you're going to go down this road on the front side, you have to set the mechanism up to adequately regulate this industry. And if you don't do that, and if you're relying on taxes on the backside, you're always going to be playing catch up with the industry. So if you're going, and state legislators across the country are it's typical, let's put out a program and figure out how to pay for it later.
Well, we're going to sell the marijuana. We're going to tax the sale a lot. We're going to take that money and use it to regulate the industry. Right? That's what we do.
That's what's supposed to happen. In theory, that's what's supposed to happen.
And why won't it happen? We're gonna buy that stuff. We're gonna tax it. We're gonna get the money. You're afraid that we aren't gonna fund the?
Oh, I know you're not, because nobody else is. I mean, you look at pension funds across the country.
No. Don't even preach to me.
Well,
look
at other entities where we've been promised we're gonna do one thing, and when the money comes in and the bigger pressing issue presents itself, that's where the money's diverted to. You look at your fine roads you got out here. You could spend all your marijuana money just on infrastructure. You've got one of the worst pension systems in the country that, thankfully, only yours is worse than Kentucky's. So, you know, things like that are going to take precedent over what should be done, and that's trying to regulate an industry that really doesn't lend itself to regulation.
The question, Ed Chimeli is in our studio. He's the national coordinator of the National Marijuana Initiative. And they work with states like ours to do what? To advise them? To tell them, here's at least what you ought to be looking out for?
We're just letting people know what's actually happened. At least we want you to make an informed decision based on what is actually occurring.
Well, we've decided to legalize marijuana, and I'm going to be able to do that real soon. The thing that I think is really on people's minds in the state of Illinois is driving under the influence, and how are they going to know, and what the definition of that is. And there are some folks from Motorola here, and they had a gadget that they'll be able to use, and in 5 minutes they'll get a readout of 6 different drugs, including THC, and is the person impaired. But I don't think that's necessarily a good indicator of impairment. Some people will be impaired that aren't over the limit. Some people won't be impaired at all, and they are. So I think a lot of us have questions about that. I know the cops do. We'll pick up the conversation here in a minute. Maybe you've got a question, too. 312-981-7200. We're talking to Ed Chimelia. He's the national coordinator of the National Marijuana Initiative. So he is in town, courtesy of the DuPage County Health Department. They have the Prevention Leadership Team. They brought him in before to talk to the folks out in DuPage County so they know what the laws are and what the issues are and what some of the things are that other states have run into. What can we anticipate in DuPage County and in the state of Illinois? I suggested just before the break, Ed, that we don't have a handle on DUI or the equivalent.
We do not. Not at all. And I think that's going to present, it's already presenting problems in these states that have legalized recreationally.
Because you're going to be able to legally smoke marijuana. I guess you can't smoke it while you're driving.
No, you can't drink while you're driving. Yeah.
Well, understood. But right. I mean, but the point is you can drink and drive, not at the same time, as long as you're not over 0.08 and you're not impaired. What is the equivalent to that? How are we going to know?
We don't. Therein lies the problem, because the science does not exist with respect to impairment at a nanogram level. We have arbitrarily assigned, and in most cases, it's a 5 nanogram whole blood impairment level. The science does not support what impairment is at that level. We have a clear body of science on what impairment with alcohol looks like. That's why we have per se laws. The problem is we don't have that with marijuana, and it's presenting problems because marijuana is playing an increasing role in the states that have recreationalized marijuana with respect to the involvement in collisions and fatalities and overall in the percent of their involvement in total DUI arrest.
I wonder if it's also a function of the users themselves not being used to it. If I'm having drinks, I know what it feels like when I'm having too much, and I think I have a general sense of what my impairment is. But I wonder if people, when they start more regularly and legally using these marijuana products that you're talking about, if they'll even know. You know, maybe some of them will, I'll say innocently, find themselves impaired on the road when it wasn't their intention.
Oh, I'm sure that may happen. But I think the bigger problem is it's going to take several years for the science to catch up with what impairment looks like with marijuana, like we have with alcohol. We don't have the field testing with alcohol that we do, with marijuana that we do with alcohol. So it's going to be incumbent on drug recognition experts, on police officers going back to doing basic fundamental police work. I saw you driving. Here's the indicators that led me to believe you may be under the influence. And that's the key word, under the influence of something. I pull you over, put you through a litany of field sobriety tests, gauge your cognitive ability, your fine motor skills, how you process information, what have you. Police officers are going to have to go back to doing fundamental police work, dotting I's, crossing T's, and being able to articulate to courts why they felt that individual was under the influence.
And they don't do that with alcohol-related stuff.
They do
right
that,
now?
But we've gotten really lazy with alcohol, and we've done a really good
because
job.
Because we blow into the device.
We blow into the device. I saw that toward the end of my career. As my troopers, their first inclination was to stick the PVT in somebody's mouth. Oh, yeah, you're there. You're gone. Instead of going through and doing what we should be doing on the front side. And using the PBT, well, I'm not really sure, so I'll use that as a last resort. So we get so reliant on technology, and we're so accustomed to technology telling us what we should or should not be doing. That's not the case with marijuana. We're not there.
Because I could be 0.07 and still be impaired, right?
Yes,
you
can.
The officer says you blew 0.07, and I say, hey, I'm out of jail. He says, no, you're not. You were still impaired. So I guess the same judgment call is going to be made on the streets with marijuana.
Yes, it is.
And people are going to be, that is a can of worms, my friend.
Oh, it's a huge can of worms, and it's happening all over the country.
I got a lot of calls and questions for you. Ron, you're on WGN Radio. Hi, Ron, you're on the air. What's up?
Hello, John and Trooper Ed. Trooper Ed, I was working in Mississippi in the 80s, and they had drive-in liquor stores where you can drive in. It's open, all open. You buy your packaged goods. You can buy an open beer in a cup, drive out. Drive out, sir, legally. In Mississippi, that was in 1980. I don't know if it's changed. So you can legally drive and drink. At least you could in the 80s in Mississippi. Now, as far as marijuana, medical marijuana or marijuana, you know, if you've been using it, I understand, in my case, since Vietnam, so we're going to go back a few years, of course, not every day, all the time, but pretty much. You know, I've specifically taken driving tests in my car, reeking of reefer, and with
So what is your point, though, that you will be able to, you have a higher tolerance is what you're telling us, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, hold on. Let me respond to that.
Well, I think what you're saying is fundamentally correct, that you who have been a long-term marijuana user understand how your body processes this drug. What we're going to see, particularly with our young people, they don't have the same level of experience, for lack of a better word, that you do with this substance. And they're going, and particularly my concern is with our younger people that that marijuana and what NIDA tells us about the harmful consequences of THC to the developing brain, particularly the frontal lobe, the executive function process where we make good sound decisions, they're not there yet. So that's my concern, is you know, based on your experiences, what it does and how it affects you. We really don't have a clear body of science to understand how that is universally applied to everybody as we do with alcohol. And therein lies the problem with marijuana.
Got just a couple minutes left. Thanks for the phone call. A couple of texts read like this. 630 said, people drive all the time impaired by alcohol because alcohol is accepted and legal and no one ever wants to address that. I'd rather someone drove after they smoked a joint than after a couple of drinks. And 219 said, sounds like typical boomer talk here about regulating potency. There has never been a death attributed to marijuana overdose. They sell alcohol that's 90% pure for people to consume. No one talks about how dangerous alcohol can be. What's your reaction to those two messages?
Well, I think for somebody to make the statement that nobody talks about how dangerous, that's the most destructive drug in this country's history. You ask any police officer in America, the one substance that has caused you more heartache or heartburn, and I go from my own personal experience, it's alcohol. It will continue to be alcohol. Alcohol has wrought more social, familial, community destruction than any other substance combined.
So then the point of these messages is that whatever that devil is, we figured out how to contain it. Maybe you are overstating the case of the dangers of or the complications of marijuana.
Yeah, no, I don't think we understand what the dangers of the complications are. That's the problem.
James, you're on WGN Radio. What's your comment or question, James?
I was actually just about to say the same thing as your guest, Ron, and I think we know for a fact that prohibition does not work. Alcohol is by far the most destructive. I'm in the military. I have seen some of the most crazy things. I've been enlisted and an officer, and I think there's no doubt about it. If you think that it's acceptable to have alcohol that's legal,
then the marijuana would be able to apply as well. I have 20 seconds left. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think time will tell.
Thanks for the call.
I think time will tell whether this actually is a good decision or not. I think right now we have no idea because we don't clearly understand. And I'm speaking with the potency of today's marijuana. What we've had since Colorado recreationalized, we may be a generation before we understand the ramifications. I'll probably be on the dark side of grass when that occurs. But that's the reality. We just don't know.
We just don't know yet. Which I think is at least good that DuPage County Health Department, thank you to the prevention leadership team, has at least brought you out there to get in front of some of these things. Ed, come back to Chicago and visit with us again in our studio.
Well, thank you for having me, John. I enjoyed it.
We always do. Ed Chimalia is the National Marijuana Initiative National Coordinator.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Oh, here I go again.
Here's John Williams.
I'll come up with another one. I thought we had quite a few in the last half hour. 207, this is John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. Remember now, Convincing Rascals is our award-winning podcast. We drop that on Thursdays. We'll have to get hustling on that after the show today, Producer Ellick. We recorded it before the show. We'll drop it around 5 o'clock this evening, and the Rascals took on a lot of topics earlier today. And stand by, my headphones only go so far. I got to reach over here and grab this now and grab that as well. In the 2:30 segment, we'll visit with Betsy Buckley, the special education coordinator at the Glen Ellen School District, who came upon the train tracks. This is like such a classic thing. And we have so many trains and so many intersections in the Chicago area with Metro and Amtrak and, for that matter, the L. Well, the L never intersects with cars and trucks, but so many instances that maybe some of you have come upon this sort of thing where a vehicle seems to be stopped on the tracks. It's classic that way. I've never seen it, but I'm sure some of you have. And the way the story I'm reading is not a lot of folks were doing a lot to help this lady. Betsy said, I had to do something. She gets out of her car and saves a family of four. What exactly happened, Betsy, after 2:30? I remember a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how to be a good guest and how to be a good host. Remember that conversation, Elif? And then it sort of devolved into Kevin and Lauren's bad dates, because which is an entirely fair characterization, but they told some pretty funny stories about stuff that happened at their places as well. And I don't remember exactly how we got onto that. Bad guest, but you know, like, you, well, I remember one of the versions, one of the kind of stories that came up, I was describing how when we lived in Minnesota, the first year we moved up, we lived near the Mall of America. And when all of our Illinois friends found out that we were like a 5-minute ride from the Mall of America, everybody was saying, "Hey, John and Brenda, how are you guys?" People we didn't, and we'd be like, "Yeah, who is this again?" And they come up and visit us. Remember, when you shop for clothes in Minnesota, you pay no sales tax. Get yourself a leather jacket, some fancy boots, a sweater. If it says $29.99, you give them $30, they give you a penny back. That plus just all the other attractions of the Mall of America. A lot of folks came up to see us.
How big exactly is the Mall of America? Like, what would you compare it to size-wise?
Like Woodfield.
I would say Milwaukee.
The whole city?
It's really big, but I'll tell you, that was my everyday mall. Listen, if you ever want to go spend some money and avoid taxes and just get out of Dodge for a weekend, I think that's a nice trip. You drive up there, they've got hotels there or adjacent to it. You know, you never have to wear a coat because they're all connected.
And they have roller coasters and stuff.
It's got a swell amusement park in the middle. It's got a movie theater. You can get married there. But I guess my point was about to be, that's the mall where I went to buy shoes and socks. I mean, it's also, if you just want to go to the Sears or the Nordstrom or whatever, just get out of your car and it looks like a big mall. You don't have to go to Legoland. Just go what you need to get and get out. It's very manageable that way. If you want to spend a day or two there, you can do that as well. So friends came up to see us. People that I knew, but not that well. And as a housewarming gift, they brought a 6-pack of beer, which was fine. And when they left a few days later, we'd only had 3 of the beers. And they went in and got the 3 beers out of the fridge and said, "Listen, we're going to go ahead and take these back with us." Which I thought in retrospect was bad form.
Were they imports? But this is before craft beers, right?
Right. Craft beers hadn't even been invented. I don't know what they were, but I should have hit them. Because the beers and those people went out the door at the same time. That was no great injury, but that got us started. And then other people had strange stories about behavior. John, my dad has a cheap friend at the bar. He had a buy one, get one coupon for dinner somewhere and went with a friend. And when the bill came, he didn't pay anything because he had the coupon. Yeah, that's a little awkward, but if you have a free meal coupon, and then you say, "Well, let's go there." You, A, have to tell them you have the coupon. And then, B, you have to split the price of the meal with that person.
I think that happened to me one time. Same thing. Someone had a coupon. They're like, "Well,
I can eat for free. I'll invite the Bertrands, and they'll pay their share."
Like, I have a 50% off the second entree, so I'm just going to pay $12.95.
Whatever the math is, you have to split it 50-50. That is not a free meal.
Never mind.
You don't want to out yourself on some measure of bad behavior there, Ms. Garris?
No, I've never done anything like that. I agree with you, actually, that the love can be shared.
A Christmas guest of mine not only brought his giant dog with him to the Christmas dinner we had without asking, when I already had 40 guests in my home, the next day he called, upset, accused me of giving his girlfriend food poisoning with my Christmas meal. No one else was sick. The girlfriend got sick. Bad guest behavior. My daughter got married last year, and as we walked into the restaurant where the rehearsal dinner was being held, the father of the groom took my husband aside and said, asked him if he wouldn't mind splitting the cost of the rehearsal dinner 50-50. My husband's jaw dropped, but we had no choice but to agree.
Wait, that just reminded... Sorry.
Go ahead, Olaf.
It reminded me of a Friends episode. It's the one where Ross gets married again, and it's with the British girl. And her parents, on the day of the rehearsal dinner, they say, "All right, so here's the bill for the kitchen that we're redoing in our house. And here's this, and here's that." And it's just, it's so funny and out of left field.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know. I didn't see the episode.
Obviously, it's not something that would happen in real life. But
an exaggeration of what happens?
Yeah.
My daughter got married last year, and as we walked into the restaurant where the rehearsal dinner was being held, traditionally, right, the bride's side pays for the wedding, the groom's side pays for the rehearsal dinner. Those lines are blurred these days. They should be, but the father of groom grabs the husband and says, hey, listen, let's go 50-50 here on the ticket. 773, tell me what you think. I took my nephew to the Stones concert this past summer for his birthday. My sister-in-law told me to get her a ticket for my brother. She said she would pay me. I haven't seen a dime. Do I ask her for the money? I'll see her at Thanksgiving. And it wasn't cheap. It was $200. I think people genuinely forget to pay people back. In fact, Steve, this may not surprise you, but I have sometimes asked people just as a sort of catch-up, just a little housekeeping. I say, do I owe you any money? Because I think they remember if I do, but sometimes I forget. And almost always the answer is, no, John, you don't owe us any money. I tried to pay somebody yesterday $5. I didn't owe him any cash.
Wish that had been me.
Tell me what you think. I took my nephew to the Stones concert. My sister-in-law told me to get her a ticket for my brother. She said she would pay me. I haven't seen a dime. Do I ask her for it? I'll see her at Thanksgiving. I would ask her before Thanksgiving. That's not hard. You just shoot him a quick note. Hey, Lois. Assuming her name's Lois. Hope that Stones ticket, the concert was great. By the way, still looking for the, I don't know what the next sentence is, but it doesn't matter. She'll get it. You don't have to be artful about it. Just, hey, you still haven't paid me. Is A-OK? You're not asking her for something that you're not due. John, I was at a bachelorette party. It started at a bar. I ordered a few mixed drinks for myself while the other girls were drinking bottles and bottles of wine. When the bill came, they wanted to split it evenly, and I refused. I didn't drink any of the wine, so I paid for my drinks. I threw in a couple of extra bucks for the bride-to-be. The rest of the girls seemed miffed at me, but I didn't care. Why should I have to pay for their drinks? That's a little grayer in my book. You can count the drinks and the bottles of wine and do the math, and somebody's going to come out ahead and somebody's going to come out behind. But I think at a situation like that, unless it's really egregious, I think you just have to split it 50-50-50, you know what I mean? But the weirdest story of all, bad guest behavior, isn't any of those. It comes after this.
The holidays are a time of family, shopping, and running around. So why not treat your feet to a custom fit at New Balance Chicago? New Balance has been a leader in foot health for over 100 years. The professionally trained staff will thoroughly assess you and fit you in the perfect pair of shoes. Experience the difference at New Balance Chicago. And give a friend a gift card so they can too. Visit New Balance Chicago at Oak Brook Terrace, Orland Park, Lincoln Park, and Schaumburg. They'll take care of you.
Do you want your basement to be dry most of the time? If so, PermaSeal is not the company for you. At PermaSeal, we believe your basement should be dry all the time, no matter how hard it rains. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer, president of PermaSeal. I hear story after story of homeowners who say their basement only leaks when it rains. Well, you don't worry about your living room or bedroom getting wet when it rains, and you should feel the same way about your basement. Just call 800-421-SEAL. We offer a free estimate, no haggle pricing, and a price assurance guarantee, so you can rest assured that you're getting the best value. Your basement is already dry most of the time, but if you want your basement dry all the time, you know who to call. 800-421-SEAL. PermaSeal has earned an A-plus rating from the BBB and has received their 2016 Torch Award for Marketplace Ethics. That's 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Your best for being better, PermaSeal.
When it comes to braving another Midwest winter, you can never be too prepared. At Blaine's Farm and Fleet, we get it. We're your winter weather experts with the gear and supplies you need to conquer the cold. Right now, save $10 on all Walls vintage jackets and vests, like men's Walls vintage Amarillo duck jackets, just $89.99. Or add a layer with men's Walls vintage Pecos duck vests, $69.99. Save 25% on zero exposure outerwear for the family and glove sets for the kids. And kids' big chill winter coats and two-piece snowsuits are half off. Plus, get your vehicle ready for winter with your choice of assorted Erickson 2-inch by 27-foot rubber ratchet hooks, only $8.99.
Save $8 on a pair of Trico Exact Fit Ultra Beam or Ice Extreme Winter Weather Wiper Blades. And buy three passenger or light truck tires from top brands like Michelin and get the fourth one free with installation. Keeping you warm and ready for winter. That's genuine value from Blaine's Farm and Fleet.
Somebody just texted in, hey, John, you owe me money. I'm surprised it took you all that long to figure that out. If you come up to me and go, remember that time I gave you $47? I will probably give you $47. I don't even know you. 224, this is Snowplow Steve, John. Have her bring over $200 worth of shrimp. Yes, before Thanksgiving, I bought a concert ticket for my cousin. The concert was in October. He never paid me the $60, so when his birthday rolled around in February, I gave him a card and told him he didn't have to pay me back for the concert anymore. That's a good way to handle it. If, in fact, you would have normally given somebody a $60 gift, next time you're due for a gift, just say, remember when you didn't pay me for the ticket I bought you?
Or let it run. Let it be a running total. $35 this birthday, $35 next birthday.
Yeah, really, you could say we're halfway. We're halfway right. To your debt cleared. Right.
They're just about to come out for the encore.
Now, that's just a little passive-aggressive, but it does do the math. John, my sister and brother-in-law borrowed money to take a family vacation, and they still haven't paid it back. That was 4 years ago. You guys, what's the expression, grow a pair? This is okay. You're not asking for something you aren't due. I suspect that the reaction from the person who owes money from the vacation, although they must know they didn't pay you for a flippin' vacation, but say it's tickets to a concert or something like that. When you say, hey, you didn't pay me for the thing, they're going to go like this. Oh, God, I can't believe it. Honey, I thought you paid the Johnsons. Oh, I feel terrible. And then they even throw in an extra $5 or a bottle of wine or something. You will do them a favor by telling them. Just say, hey, Johnny, you didn't pay me. Now, the vacation thing is probably them just scamming you. They had no intention of paying for it. You're not going to be friends anymore. You bought them a vacation. Cut your losses. But, Steve, I heard this story, and tell me what you just think about this. What should Mary do now? This is the story about Mary, who is a single mom. And after her daughter went away to school, she took that room that the daughter stayed in and had the carpet redone and the linens redone and redid it as a wonderful guest room. So Mary now lives alone, but she's got a wonderful guest room. And her friends Kim and Kevin show up to stay overnight. They were in town. Hey, it's so great to get together. And they all went out with some other friends and they partied. And frankly, Kim and Kevin probably had a couple more cocktails than would have been advisable, especially Kevin. And at 3 o'clock that morning, Mary wakes up to find Kevin standing in her bedroom with a towel around his waist.
Yeah?
And he says, something really bad has happened downstairs. And so she gets up with him and they go downstairs to the guest bedroom and vomit is everywhere. And it's colored red wine.
Yes.
And it's ruined the rug and the linens and everything. And so there she is at 3 a.m. with a bucket and stripping the sheets and remaking the bed and trying to clean out the carpet. It's just a ruinous mess. And they get that all tended to. And then they all go back to bed. And the next morning, Kevin is in town for business. He's off doing his thing. She didn't see him again, as I recall. And they have not offered to pay for any of the inconvenience.
Yikes. And these are friends?
Yeah.
Not anymore.
That's awkward. But I think here again, you know, I mean, so what would you do if that was you? You know, you would just be sick about having done that. What bad behavior.
I have a very similar story, unfortunately.
We all know that's true.
Yeah, we're not surprised.
No, listen.
Wait.
I was in college, and as college students do, or college kids, I drank too much, underage, and I threw up all over my friend's couch where I was staying, and I offered to pay for the steam clean.
That's what you got to do. But you might have to buy him a new couch.
Right. It was embarrassing.
I know. You are so embarrassed that the next day, you go get a $500 gift card
for
Bed Bath
something.
& Beyond. Whatever it is that's going to make at least that hole again, that's what you have to do. To say nothing of you, but you can't fix your bad behavior. In this case, they didn't do either.
Well, you can by not doing that same thing again.
I learn
a lot from that.
Promise to never do it again.
Yeah.
And then B, that you've got to get him new everything. Didn't happen in this case. Bad guest behavior. So if you've got more texts along those lines, A, don't do that, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the telephone number. There was one other thing I was going to mention about the mayor. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, in a press conference, this happened yesterday. She's a Bears season ticket holder, offered advice to a team mired in a disappointing 4-6 season. The Bears must be better, mayor's orders, in a press conference yesterday. She said, find an offense, and Eddie Pinheiro, find your leg again. The Bears kicker missed 2 first-quarter field goals against the Rams Sunday night. Lightfoot met Pinheiro on the field before the season opener against the Packers. She introduced herself. She wished him luck. And then remember, he hit some terrific field goals. We were kind of in it for the first half dozen games anyway, because in part of the kicking of Eddie Pinheiro. The topic turned at the press conference yesterday to the Bears on Wednesday when the mayor, speaking after a city council meeting, was asked what she's going to do for Thanksgiving. She said her 91-year-old mother was coming over. She said, my mom's a big football fan, so I'm sure we'll watch a little bit of it. She said of the Bears-Lions game, the question is, will it be worth watching, the mayor said. That remains to be seen. But I like the idea of Eddie Pinheiro, find your leg again. Mark Harmon said this guy is going to be a soccer player or... He does not have a career in professional football, kicking a football. I'll defer to Carmen anytime. So maybe he shouldn't be a professional kicker. But I'm intrigued by the idea that Eddie Pinheiro can kick a field goal, but then for some reason he just loses the talent. He loses the skill. I was watching West Wing this week. Brendan and I are going back, and we started season 1, episode 1, and we're going to plow all the way through. And in about episode 6 of West Wing season 1, Rob Lowe's character, he's a speechwriter for the president, frets that he's temporarily lost his talent. It's not exactly writer's block, but he just has lost the flourish that he had. Everything is dry and flat, and he can't get his mojo back. And I'll bet that happens to a lot of people in various aspects of their life, right? I don't know if singers suddenly can't sing or actors suddenly can't act. I don't know if accountants suddenly can't do whatever it is you guys do. But I think that it's 100% possible that an Eddie Pinheiro can, quote unquote, get it back, that he'll find his leg again and he'll be able to kick field goals. That's small consolation to the Bears if it doesn't happen while they're paying him. But I think anybody that can kick it that far and have had that success probably can lose it and can then get it back. Ella said, you got to take a break. I'm reading some text messages here. Steve, about the people who sometimes forget to pay off debts.
Yes.
John, my brother borrowed $10,000 from me about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, and now he doesn't speak to me anymore.
Well, why would he?
Dave texted in and said, just borrow the money back. If someone owes you $200, go to that person and ask them for $200. Just say, hey, listen, could you pick up that thing for me? I'll pay you back. And then never pay them back. 773, I lent a so-called friend $10. He did not pay it off. I cut him off. He didn't pay it back, so I cut him off. The best $10 I have ever given away. Good riddance. Well, maybe that wasn't such a good friend then. John, yeah, you ask for the money back. We read a text message from somebody who described a scene where they loaned somebody money for the Stones tickets and they never paid him back. Yeah, John, you asked for the money for the Stones tickets. She may have forgotten. That happened to me once with Cubs tickets and somebody, and I just forgot. I think that's really possible for some of these cases. Life's busy and, you know, you're not missing the money, so it's not searing your consciousness, but it might be the other person's. John, listen to this, Steve. My son-in-law always orders the most expensive thing on the menu. Then he takes 2 bites and leaves the remaining. He expects me to pay the bill. I stopped buying dinner for him. Well, I think what they're saying is he takes 2 bites and then just takes it home and eats it as his leisure. I presume they mean that. I don't know how you keep score on that one. But it sounds like he's enjoying your company, but he's really just enjoying your money, right? My son-in-law always orders the most expensive thing on the menu. He takes two bites. He expects me to pay the bill. I stop buying dinner for him. That is your son-in-law. I'd sure like to know where the bride is at this dinner, the wife is. Betsy Buckley's on the phone. Hey, Betsy, it's John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I'm really good. Real nice picture of you in the Sun Times today.
Thank you very much.
What do you do for a living?
I am a special education coordinator.
You were in LaGrange the other day?
I was in LaGrange on my way home from work in Glen Ellyn. And driving along, thinking I was going to get home and make tacos with my family.
What was the street you were on? Because I used to live in LaGrange. I know that line and the metro line there and the Burlington Northern and the cross streets. Where were you?
I was on Shawmut by the Life Storage right there.
Okay. So you're heading north, are you?
I was heading north. I had just come through the underpass, and I was heading north, and I was then curving to the right, going east over the train tracks, and I noticed the car on the train tracks.
What do you mean you noticed a car on the train tracks? What did you see?
So as I was driving north parallel with the train tracks, I looked over, and I saw this like an SUV family kind of vehicle in a kind of a strange angle on the train tracks. And couldn't see anybody at that moment, but then as I was going over, I looked again and still couldn't tell if anybody was in the car, but it was definitely on the tracks down from the road a little bit, like they were trying to use it as a street.
Huh. So the vehicle is stopped there. Is it stuck there? I mean, why are they still sitting there?
So I think that it was, I never found out the answer to that, and people have been asking me, but I think that it was stuck based on the angle of the car. But the other compounding factor was there was a train heading south on the train tracks. So I think the family inside had to make a decision. Do we keep trying to put it in reverse, or do we get out of the car now? As I parked my car and came around, that's when I saw the family exiting the vehicle.
They're still in there. Were the gates down? Was it one of those cases where people are trying to go around the gates?
No. It was a family, a grandmother and her daughter, and then her two grandchildren in the back. And I guess they had been in an appointment, and they're not from around here, and it was dark, and they were getting lost, so they decided to put on the GPS to get themselves back in the right direction. And the GPS told them to turn left, because the road does angle to the left.
So they turned left kind of onto the tracks and got wedged there.
Yep. They turned left too early.
Wow. You know, there's these crazy stories about people who drive into a lake or a river because the GPS told them.
But yes.
I'm not making fun of these people, but I mean, doggone it. If the thing says turn left onto the train tracks, you got to rethink your decision there.
Correct.
So you get out, but they're also getting out, right?
Well, when I got out, I pulled my car over after I got over the train tracks and to see then what was going on with this car, and that's when I saw the family exiting their vehicle. So I just, in that split-second moment, I thought, I have time to get over there and back. So I just started running to them, yelling, "How can I help? How can I help?" Because I saw the grandmother struggling with the little four-year-old girl, and her leg was just kind of looped underneath the seatbelt. And in that moment, I think the grandmother was just not able to get her loose. So I just ran over there and I flipped her little leg and I picked her up, and then we all ran to the side to safety near where my car was parked.
So then what happened?
We watched the train hit their car.
How much time between when you all got out of the way and the train hit the vehicle?
Not much time at all. I'd say start to finish, it was about a minute, maybe a minute and a half.
A minute, well, start to finish. I mean, so you guys clear the way, here comes the train, and then 60 seconds later the train hit the vehicle?
No, like 10 seconds. We were safely on the side, and we literally just turned looked to the right, to the north, and saw the train cross the tracks and go right into their car.
How fast do you guess the train was going?
Well, I think it was not going as fast as it typically would. I think that the train had been slowing down, seeing the train, the car on the tracks, because during this whole scenario, of course, the train is really loud and making and honking its horn or pulling its horn, and so it was a high stress. Like you kept hearing the whistle of the horn of the train blowing, and so the police officer said that if it had not been trying to stop at all, it would have been much farther down the tracks when it finally did come to a halt.
Yeah. Well, this was a freight train. You know, the commuter trains will do 70 miles an hour through LaGrange.
Yeah.
The freight trains don't do that, and they don't even use the tracks that I'm thinking about, but 20 miles an hour, something like that, it really doesn't matter how fast a train is going, I guess. If a train hits you, it's going to end badly. And it also sounds like the woman panicked, right? I mean, she probably 10 times out of 10 could have figured out what the problem was to get the granddaughter out. But now a train's coming, the horn's honking, it's night, and you don't think clearly, right?
Yes, I think that's exactly. When you're stressed out and your anxiety is very high, sometimes you freeze, sometimes you run the other way, sometimes you can't figure out a very simple problem. Your anxiety goes up and your memory and your functional skills go the opposite direction. Yeah. So just in that moment, luckily I was one that just, I don't know, I just ran over and just seemed all clear to me what to do.
Amen to that. But I mean, were there other people that could have aided as well? Were there other people driving by or walking by, or were you just alone in this scene?
There were other cars that had been going over the train tracks. There were not any pedestrians around.
But I mean, what was the matter with those people? I think, I don't know if I would have been. I mean, you're the hero in this story, and I don't know that everybody would have done what you did, but other people were obviously ignoring the plight of those people, huh?
I guess so. Or they didn't think it was odd to have a car parked, you know, 20 yards down from where they were supposed to be. I can't speak for them, but certainly nobody else stopped.
20 yards down, it was so they made that left turn too soon, and then ba-boom, 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 we're driving down the railroad tracks?
Yeah, it was down a little bit, probably. My judgment of distance is not so great, but it was down a little bit.
Wow, so more than just they turned and went, oops, they then actually went to distance.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct, yeah. So that was added to it, right? So if their tire was, I mean, they literally were on those big gravel rocks part of the tracks, and I know that the driver's side was in the path of a train.
You must have thought when you're coming up on this scene, like, I'm just trying to get home and cook tacos. Now I'm running down a dark train, and here comes a train. I mean, that must have just seemed surreal to you.
It still is a little surreal, to be honest with you. But yeah, at first it was like just curiosity, like, what the heck? Why is that car? Why is it there? And then it quickly went from curiosity to just like insta action.
Yeah.
I was no longer curious. It was just, like I said, just kind of clear what needed to be done. And I had to reassure my family that I wasn't intentionally putting myself in harm's way. In that moment, I knew that I had enough time to help them.
Well, I'm glad that you did, and maybe you did put yourself in harm's way, but you weren't harmed, so I'd say if you can survive that scene, do put yourself in harm's way, but obviously not all of us do. Thank goodness for Betsy Buckley. Last thing, Betsy, then, did you all embrace? Did they take your name and say, we'll send you flowers? I mean, how does that moment end then for you all?
Yeah, well, we were there for over an hour. My car was like the warming station for the group.
Uh-huh.
And so we hugged many times. The grandma kept calling me her angel.
Yeah.
And I got to spend a lot of time with the little girl. We were drawing pictures in the back of my car. So I was helping her feel, you know, at ease and realize that she was safe and everything was going to be okay.
From Glen Ellen, Betsy Buckley, nicely done. And I appreciate you sharing your story with us, Betsy. My best to you and your family.
Thank you. And I'm from LaGrange Park.
Holy cow. I used to live on Wyola.
Oh, Oh, wow. Okay.
What street were you on when you were in LaGrange Park?
I live on Newberry.
Oh, you still live in LaGrange Park?
I do. I work in Glen Ellen.
Oh, that's right. So you're on your way. I see. Yeah.
I was almost home. Yep.
Good to hear you, Betsy. Well done. Thanks for your call.
Yes, no problem. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
We called her. Thanks for your time. Happy Thanksgiving to her. Like many of you, when I can't sleep at night, I read books by Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador. Her book is titled With All Due Respect, Defending America with Grit and Grace. And the book has been out. I knew that Ro was going to interview her. And in fact, we thought that she might be in our studio yesterday to talk to us. So I had the book and I started to read it. And anytime I read a book about somebody that I have one opinion about, I find that it gets shaded a little bit more in the opposite direction. How can it not when you sort of read about whole people rather than just soundbite people? You get a better sense of who they are and what they are. She said things in this book that I literally underlined because I thought, I can't believe you're saying that, lady. And if I get a chance to talk to you, I'm going to challenge you on that. But I also learned things about her that I just didn't know. Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador. Her parents were well-to-do and well-connected. They were from India. They had a four-story house. They moved for a better life, though, from India to the United States. The whole family did. She has a sister. Being of Indian-American heritage, but living in South Carolina was not always easy for them. And then she just tells some stories about what her youth was like. They had beauty pageants in her small town when the Haley girls were 4 and 8. She said, we weren't a pageant family, but they wanted to be part of the community, so they're going to be in the pageants. And in their town, the way they would do the beauty pageant is they would line the girls up according to color. The black girls would be over here, and the white girls would be over there, and one girl from each group would get the beauty pageant crown. They'd have two winners. And when they lined them up, they put the Haley girls in between because they couldn't decide if they were black or brown, black or white. You know, their skin's browner. And so they disqualified them and sent them home with consolation prizes. She was in a new school in South Carolina, and the kids were playing on the playground, kickball. And when she came up to play, they said, you can't play. And she said, why? And they said, they were playing blacks against whites. And they said, you're neither. And what are you? Which team are you going to be on? You can't play. And she said, well, I'm neither. I'm brown. And she grabbed the ball and ran, which kind of became a metaphor for how she lived her life thereafter. You know, take the ball and run with it. You know, declare who you are and stand by it. Her dad still wears a turban to this day. But so as to better blend into the community, he put an American flag bumper sticker on their car. Her mom voted for the president. She voted for Donald Trump. And when Nikki Haley, as a governor, endorsed Marco Rubio and then Ted Cruz, her mom was kind of ticked. Said, I don't know why you're going that way. How about this Trump guy? Donald Trump then asked her eventually to be Secretary of State. You know, Rex Tillerson got the job, and she and Rex Tillerson did not get along at all. She said, I'm not qualified to be Secretary of State. You need to get somebody who can hit the ground running. And then they came back to her sometime later, and they said, how about UN Ambassador? How about Ambassador to the United Nations? And she went back and forth on that and eventually decided to take the job. It was ironic because now she's going to leave her. She'd never been north, she said, of the state line. And now she's going to go to New York, live and work at the United Nations. So she and her husband and their two kids move up there, and they picked out a school that they thought would be good for her son. She was one of the first cabinet officers picked, by the way. And she said, I want to be a UN ambassador isn't always this, but she said, I want to be on the National Security Council. I don't want to have to answer to anybody but the president. And I want to be a cabinet member, NSC cabinet member. And I don't have to talk to Rex Tillerson or anybody else. I'll go right to Donald Trump. And Trump said, okay, done. So she becomes the ambassador. They move up to New York and they pick out a school for her son. And at her son's school, they have grief counselors to help everybody manage the fact that Donald Trump is now the president of the United States. Welcome. Welcome to New York and welcome to the school. And then she talks about the various affairs that she had to deal with in her time in office. And she gets specifically to the part that's making news in this book is where she talks about a meeting she had with John Kelly and Rex Tillerson. Yeah, and I can finish this story tomorrow, can't I, Elif? It's the part where she says that they were deciding what was best for the United States, not supporting the president, but doing what they thought was in the country's best interest. And I think it's an interesting quandary for somebody that's serving Donald Trump. You have to serve Donald Trump, help him do the best job he can, but he got elected, right? And that's your call. But she says that these guys were deciding that Donald Trump wasn't capable of making the right decision, and they were working around him. And if you were in that position, what would you do? She says you got to support the president. Starting December 2nd, that'll be a Monday, Elif and I are moving from this show to the 9 a.m. to noon slot. You may have heard about that. Maybe you're hearing about it for the first time. I don't mean to shock you, but I don't want to talk about this at all, and I don't want to talk about it much right now. We'll have time to talk about it between now and then. But 9 to noon is where Elif and I are going. The John Williams Show will be from 9 to noon. Anna DeVlantis, who you hear with Ro Khan every day, will host her own show in this time slot. And all of that means that Bill and Wendy are no longer with WGN. I do not know anyone who doesn't love Bill and Wendy personally or love their show. Our station management wants the shows to be single hosts, talking more directly to you, taking calls, listening to the voices of Chicago, talking about things that the WGN radio listeners are dealing with and talking about every day, about your personal lives and what's going on in Chicago with single hosts. Bill and Wendy can do that, but then it becomes a numbers game, and they've always worked as a team. I don't want to talk much about it because I wasn't, of course, at all involved in these decisions, but I can tell you how the decision was laid out before me. It's not that anybody doesn't like Bill and Wendy, good Lord, but that's the way it's going to go, and we wish them well. I talked to Bill off the air today. I'll talk to Wendy after the show, and there are not two more competent or capable people doing what they do than those two. I'm sure they'll come back and haunt us some way on another station someday. And so that's the way it is. We'll be in this slot until December 2nd. That's a Monday. And then I'll be back on a show that I did for many years here at WGN Radio from 9 to noon. I love the 9 to noon show. I don't like it under these circumstances. But that's where we're going to be. And I wish Anna DeVlantis well. I think she's going to have a terrific show here with you. I know Rose going to miss her. And we also have most of another week left in the current configurations of the show. Thanksgiving's going to get in the way for some of us next week, but that's the way it goes. You've been reading about it and hearing about it. And we'll talk more about that next week.